Decentraland Podcast with David Amoyala.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the Calcioland Podcast of the Week. So the theme of today's podcast is drama. We have everything that happened with Icardi on the past few days. We'll have Alex Goldberg's back today after Monday. It's not that he was off after Chelsea got destroyed from Man City. It was my travel schedule, so he's back. We'll talk with him at the top on this. We have our game picks with our dear friend Thousand Names. We have some great Twitter questions from our listeners. And on the theme of drama, we'll continue talking about Icardi and the whole Pazza Inter thing with our dear friend Andrew Barker. And the second part of the interview with Andrew will be a preview of the Oscars. We had a very fun chat on some of the better movies at the Academy Awards. But before we get to all that, I am joined by our great friend Alex Goldberg, producer, co-host of the podcast. So, Alex, very simply, this has been the past few days of Icardi. So I want to ask you, what was your initial reaction when on Wednesday morning we found out that Icardi was first stripped of the captaincy at Inter via cryptic tweet and then followed by his refusal to travel with the team for the Europa League match?
Yeah, I was pretty surprised, David, and actually immediately, just maybe because I have a transfer mind or because Chelsea really need a striker, I was immediately thinking, oh, great, Icardi should come to Chelsea. But no, then when I really started thinking about it, I was, you know, I never would say I saw this coming, because how could you in terms of losing captaincy and then him refusing to travel? That's pretty profound. You can't really predict that. However, I just have had a feeling since the summer, maybe from afar, sometimes you even have a better feeling rather than if you're paying attention to every Inter news report, rumor, what have you. I just had a feeling like Icardi's days have been numbered at Inter for a while now. And with everything with Juan Dinara, and that's not your typical agent, and just Icardi's personality that you've told me about, that many Serie A people have told me about, I don't think people should be surprised that it's Icardi, of all people, in this drama, so to say. It's a crucial time of year for this drama to be going on. So my initial reaction was surprised, but then thinking about it deeper, like, okay, well, fine. It's not like it's Samir Handanovic, who's now the captain. It's Icardi. He's not exactly a perfect citizen of a team. Now, that's not to say that I think he's a cancer in the dressing room or anything of that stretch, but he's not exactly a quiet soldier, I would put it that way. So based on who the person is, who the player's agent is, I'm not totally surprised. And it does make me believe that Icardi's days at Inter are very numbered and he will not be on Inter next season. So that was kind of, you asked my initial reaction. That was my initial reaction. I just started immediately thinking about teams that he would go to because I just don't see him being at Inter for much longer. So, David, that was my take. What about you?
Yeah, I think the timing, as you said, was very interesting. So obviously, this is a crucial part of the season for Inter. They stopped the bleeding a little bit with the win against Parma, but they were in free fall. Before that, there was these issues with Perisic as well. So the timing was certainly odd. Kind of like you, like I went the transfer route a little bit, but not so much, you know, what teams he could join. But right away, it made me think of, you know, how people start asking me transfer questions, you know, for the January window in September and for the summer window. People have already been asking me a lot of stuff. And I always say, you know, it's way too soon for that because so much can change. So it's really kind of speculative to get into what could happen now, unless, of course, it's a Bosman signing for the following season. And this is precisely a case of this, because I was certain Icardi wasn't leaving in January. And I was even at the point that I was certain he wasn't going to leave this year, no matter what, because he had toughed it out at Inter when Inter wasn't particularly good. They look on track before this incident, at least, to make it back to the Champions League for the second year in a row, which was the objective of the team. Inter is definitely a team on the rise. They're about to get their FFP issues put them behind them. So there's definitely a lot of reasons for optimism at Inter. And he's also been a loyal soldier when they weren't good. My other reaction is like, and I've seen some tweets about this that I find really interesting, that maybe when we can talk about Icardi's loyalty to Inter, and that's a big aspect of it, but maybe he's also the kind of guy that would rather be the signature player on a team. Somewhat similar to Totti, but not exactly, because Totti, you know, was from the city of Roma, really identified with that. And as much as I like Icardi, I mean, Totti in his prime was clearly a much better player, and he could have been the main star on any team. But maybe Icardi always kind of saw himself, you know, I can kind of be the symbol of Inter, not have to worry. Yeah, I have the pressure, but I am clearly the most important player on the team. So I had a lot of kind of reactions in that sense. But again, it reminded me why things can change so rapidly with transfer moves. And I know some people, we're going to get to some questions on the Twitter a question part of the podcast, and it's like you always should take that stuff with a grain of salt. But another thing that I wanted to ask you about this, Alex, is obviously we've seen a lot of changes at Inter since Marotta arrived from Juve. We've seen, you know, maybe the team be more pragmatic. They with Nainggolan, they suspended him, they handled that head on. We saw what they're doing with Icardi. This is definitely a different Inter, and we got into this deep when we in the interview with Andrew Barker. But I have to ask you, would you say even the cost of sacrificing Icardi to change the culture completely and make it more about Juve? And when I think of Juve, I think of the fact that when Ronaldo arrived, they didn't do a presentation in the stadium with all the fans making it a huge deal about Ronaldo. They did in typical Juve fashion, was just a regular press conference like any other player. Juve is all about the club, not the individual. We also saw that the way Del Piero, Buffon, and even Marchisio left. So I have to ask you, you know, the craziness at Inter in a lot of ways has held them back in the past few years. Do you think sacrificing someone as good as Icardi, there might be some logic to this?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, is it risky? Because Icardi is a damn good striker. And as we've said, Inter in a crucial part of the season, both in Serie A and Europe. Absolutely, it's risky. But I believe in it, and I love the way Juve does things. I really do. No players above the club. And I promise I'll make this comparison really short, but I always compare, David, as you know, Juve to the New England Patriots, and it's exactly the same there. Bill Belichick is famous for cutting all-star players, Pro Bowl players, and there's really nobody he will not reprimand or leave out if they're not following the rules. I mean, heck, David, the second Super Bowl ago, not this last Super Bowl, but the one before, he benched in the freaking Super Bowl the Patriots' best cornerback. So I like that. Now, it didn't work out in that game, but overall, I like that kind of attitude towards the team. And how will it benefit Inter? Well, think about it. Who's going to be Icardi's replacement? Lautaro Martinez. What type of a message does that send to somebody like him? A great message in terms of, hey, you can have a great career here. You can score 20 goals a season. But if you act up and you don't abide by our rules, you're going to be dropped just as well. So I really think it actually sends a great message to the rest of the club. So is it a risk? Yes. But am I kind of in favor of excluding Icardi now and changing the culture? Yeah, I think it's a good move. And I'm not saying just follow everything that Juve does, because Juve's team is really hard to replicate. But I think it's a really good move for the culture of Inter. And I think it'll only help them in the long run ascend towards stability. So, David, that's my answer. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely with you. It's a risk, because finding a goal scorer of Icardi's caliber is probably the most difficult and most expensive thing to do on the transfer market. I also saw Gab Marcotti had a very interesting article on how most of the top scorers in the top leagues in Europe are all older than Icardi. So it is tough. But you mentioned Lautaro Martinez. And if you read any of when Spalletti talks about Lautaro Martinez, he basically says that he plays the center forward position in exactly the same role as Icardi. And I think he says that to explain why they very rarely play together unless it's a desperation move at the end of a match. So I think, you know, the risk on this is also how much you believe in Lautaro Martinez. You know, maybe Inter moves on from Icardi, although I personally think there's a decent chance that it gets resolved and he stays there. But if they do, it could be a very different team and they invest in other areas and Lautaro plays the position in a similar manner. but remains to be seen because Icardi is the type of striker that guarantees you 18, 20 goals a season. So, Alex, let's close the segment on Icardi on this. And we had talked about the Ewing theory with Higuain at Milan, but, you know, it doesn't really fit the Ewing theory very quickly for those of you who've talked about it on the podcast. But this is when a team that's never won anything loses their signature player, and all of a sudden they start playing better and winning. And it's based on Patrick Ewing on the New York Knicks, and he had a serious injury, and the Knicks made it all the way to the NBA Finals, and there was a lot of research on them actually winning more games when he didn't play. So not only did we have the drama with Icardi, and look, right now he's still at Inter, but there's no denying that after these events, there's a much better chance he leaves. And today, we're recording this on Friday, Hamsik had his going away press conference at Napoli. So I have to ask you, which team has better Ewing theory potential? Inter without Icardi or Napoli without Hamsik?
Yeah, this is not an easy one to answer, David. Now, from a culture standpoint and from kind of a rallying of the troops standpoint, I want to say Inter because, as I said in the previous answer, just kind of sends a message to the rest of the team and gets everybody on the same page. The Hamsik situation is not as similar in terms of the Icardi's one, in terms of maybe how the other players will react. But I'm actually going to say Napoli has the better chance at the Ewing theory from a playing standpoint. And I think that's still most important because the Ewing theory, you got to perform once that said player is no longer with you. And I think Napoli does have an opportunity to almost be better suited for the type of football Ancelotti wants to play, the type of football he has been playing all season long. Now, that's not to discredit Hamsik's career with Napoli. It was tremendous, but obviously it was through a couple different managers, and I think there were previous systems that were better for Hamsik. And now it really does give Ancelotti the chance to just continue forward with his 4-4-2 that he still has used much of the season, using Alon and Fabian Ruiz and then Zielinski. And I always question, how does Hamsik really fit into that formation? Because I've never really seen him as a midfielder in 4-4-2, meaning two central midfielders. I always kind of see Hamsik in, you know, 4-3-3 with like Maurizio Sarri as a third midfielder in a midfield three. So I honestly think this is just going to be an opportunity for someone like Fabian Ruiz, who I'm definitely a big fan of this season, and Zielinski, who has had his ups and downs, but definitely is a player that deserves more minutes, and Alon is obviously irreplaceable. I think they might fit better together now. I really think this might be a chance. And, I mean, it is just a changing of the guard. Hamsik's been there for so long that I really think the players will have no choice but to get together and play the type of football they have to play. They have to play. So I don't think it's an easy answer. I really don't. And actually, my gut was to go with Inter, but the more I think about actually how Napoli wants to play football, I'm going to say that Napoli has the better chance at the Ewing theory applying. So, David, that's my take. What about you?
Yeah, like before, I think it ultimately comes down to how much you believe in Lautaro Martinez. I think Hamsik, you know, starting last season was still a big name player, maybe not contributing as much as he did. Napoli stacked in the midfield, although they might feel a little bit short now there because it was a little bit puzzling that they knew Hamsik was leaving. They loan out Raj, who, you know, a talented player who had played that much, so they're a little bit thin there, and it's not in the midfield, but now Albiol looks like he's out for this season, but I do think Napoli is definitely a good contender for the Europa League to win it. But I also think the Icardi thing could energize Inter and seal the deal for them finishing in the Champions League, which really is their objective. Their objective is probably easier than Napoli's. And I think at this point, Napoli has to go all in the Europa League. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about Sarri this week. But ultimately, Ancelotti, as much as he's doing all the things Sarri was criticized for not doing, Napoli's still out of the Champions League, still out of the Coppa Italia. As of now, they have 8 less points than when Sarri was at the club this time last year. So to me, they have to go all in the Europa League. So the Ewing theory for them, to me, they have to win the Europa League. And that's a pretty daunting task. So you can make a case for either, but definitely a fascinating situation. And it really fits more than Higuain. So I'm definitely excited to also write an article about this because I find this theory fascinating.
Yes, definitely. This is heavily dependent on Lautaro Martinez not getting injured. That's for sure. All right, David, we have Serie A ahead of us. So, like we do every Thursday or Friday, we do our game picks with you and Thousand Names. What do we have this week from you and Thousand?
Okay, so let's start. We're recording this on Friday morning. Juve is playing later this afternoon against Frosinone because they have the Champions League match. So let's start there. You guys by now know the drill. Thousand Names picks three matches. I know his picks ahead of time, but he's the one that picks the matches. So he has Juve beating Frosinone 3-0. Goals by Mandzukic, brace from Dybala. As usual, I don't need to translate this. Ronaldo sbaglia rigore. And he says the Portuguese is in the middle of a nervous breakdown because after 3 years of winning in the Champions League, he's getting ready to be eliminated. And he says Allegri is really starting to see Zidane's shadow. In Italian, for our listeners tuning in to see what Thousand is up to, Juve Frosinone 3-0, Mandzukic Dybala, Ronaldo sbaglia calcio di rigore. Il portoghese in preda ad una crisi di nervi, dopo 3 anni di vittorie si prepara a perdere in Champions. Allegri vede l'ombra di Zidane. So it looks like Juve is going with most of their starting lineup. There's even talk that Chiellini, who's coming back from an injury, is playing, which some could see as a gamble, but maybe it's also Allegri wants to get him some playing time before the crucial matches against Atletico. And I will say, for me, Juve's season really starts in those matches against Atletico. But before we get to that, I'm also going to pick Juve to win here. I'm going to have Juve winning 2-0, and I'll give a goal to Khedira and Dybala. So next match, Thousand Name, intriguing match. This is Sampdoria traveling to Milano to face Inter. And this is interesting because it's Icardi's former team. It doesn't sound like he's playing. And Thousand has Inter winning 2-0, goals by D'Ambrosio and Nainggolan. And he says, without Icardi, Spalletti takes off. And he says, the beautiful game that Giampaolo puts on the pitch gets destroyed and that Quagliarella won't score anymore. In Italian, Inter Samp 2-0, D'Ambrosio Nainggolan. Senza Icardi, Spalletti vola, asfaltato il profeta del bel gioco di Giampaolo, Quagliarella non segna più. This is a tough one, because I will say Sampdoria is very good at home, not so much on the road. I think Inter is going to have some positive nervous energy. I'm going to have them winning 1-0, and I'm going to give a goal to Perisic, who has been playing better recently. Last pick by match by Thousand, and I think this is probably the juiciest match of the weekend with some Champions League implications. We have Milan taking a short trip to Bergamo to face Atalanta. Thousand Names has Atalanta Milan 1-1. Goals by Paqueta and an own goal by Bakayoko. Says Donnarumma is going to save a penalty, and that Gattuso, the good luck's going to keep helping Gattuso, but the fourth place there's going to be more distance for Milan from fourth place. In Italian, Atalanta Milan 1-1, Paqueta Bakayoko, Donnarumma para rigore, Gattuso avanti con fortuna, ma il quarto posto si allontana. This is a really tough match, and I hate agreeing with Thousand on all three picks, but I'm going to, and I'm going to have it as 0-0. Milan has had really an excellent defense recently. Gattuso, if you remember the beginning of the season, they never had clean sheets, and that's really changed recently. So I'm going to have it as a draw, 0-0. So Thousand Names agree, Inter beating Samp, Juve beating Frosinone, and Atalanta beating Milan. It's been a while, but I love it when our listeners tweet the picks under the episode. So if you want to see how you stack up against Thousand and I, please send them in. And now you have the advantage that we have the same picks. So now that this segment is out of the way, let's get to our favorite part of the podcast. And these are the questions from our listeners. We didn't do any on Monday because we ran the two interviews because of my travel schedule. So we have some from earlier in the week and some more recent ones. So which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, Dave, we got to start off with the most topical one, that's for sure. With the Chinese market still open, could Icardi be moved there before the end of the month? Or after all this drama, could Icardi stay at Inter?
Yeah, well, the first part, I'd be absolutely floored if he went to China. I just don't see it. I think Inter, there's been talk, even both Spalletti and sporting director Ausilio saying, hey, you know, we stripped him of the captaincy. We had to send a strong signal on this, but we do want to use him. We do want to patch things up. I just don't see Cardi going to China, although Inter does have a club affiliated with them out there. That I don't see at all. And again, this Inter is not like every other club. And look, see, people have pointed out that with Marotta there, maybe this is a complete breakage. But you'll hear, too, I think Andrew in the interview that you'll hear in a little bit made a lot of good points. There's really a lot of reasons why for both makes sense to patch things up. I mean, Icardi still has a lot of value on the transfer market, but you have to think after these events, it's taken a hit because he could be seen as a distraction. I mean, I know you, Alex, with the Chelsea thing, and right away I had some Chelsea fans tweeting me about it. Like, to me, it seems like there's enough of a circus at Chelsea for someone like Icardi, but maybe on a more serious club, we could see it. I know there's been a lot of talk about him going to Juve. That I don't see. I think if Juve makes a very big investment, it really shouldn't be at the striker position. So we'll see. If I had to give a percentage now, I'm still going to give 35% that he stays at Inter. Definitely more likely that he leaves. But again, I'm still going to say there's a more than decent chance he stays.
Yeah, to be honest, he's a damn good striker. So it's not like I'm not interested in Icardi as a Chelsea fan. But I do question if he is a perfect fit for Maurizio Sarri's system. Then again, who knows where Maurizio Sarri will be next year. All right, Dave, next Twitter question. Who do you reckon will qualify for the Champions League after the recent events?
So we did this not that long ago. You and I made our picks. I think Juve and Napoli obviously are gimmies at this point. I'm going to say I think Milan's going to make it all the way to third. And I think then it really comes down to Inter and Roma. I think Lazio has a chance, but they have a lot of injuries right now. Atalanta's surging. So it really, but I think if I had to say it really comes down to Roma and Inter the most. And as much as I like Roma and they are surging, we'll have to see what happens in the Champions League. It's great if they pass the round against Porto, but maybe it's more important for them to finish fourth. So I think it really comes down to those two. As of now, I'm still going to give an edge to Inter. I'm going to put you on the spot, Alex. How do you think this plays out?
Yeah, David, I absolutely think it's still going to be what I originally gave Juve, Napoli, Inter, and Milan. I understand fourth place is just so, so up for grabs with obviously Roma and Atalanta and Lazio right behind Milan. But I am a sucker for momentum, and I like what's going on with Milan, and I do not think Inter is going to slip that far. So I'm going to also say Juve, Napoli, Inter, and Milan. All right, David, next Twitter question. Is Donnarumma the best goalkeeper in Serie A?
I think so. I think it's you can absolutely make the best case for him. He's been excellent this season. I think his really only bad match came in the derby against Inter. Aside from that, he's been close to flawless. Too, there's been obviously a lot of change at the goalkeeper position in Serie A. Buffon going to PSG, Alisson, who last season was clearly the best goalkeeper in Serie A, going to Liverpool. I think Szczesny has been better recently, but he didn't get off to a brilliant start. Handanovic, to me, I think it really comes down to Donnarumma and Handanovic then. And I'm going to give an edge to Donnarumma. I'm a big fan of Handanovic, but I've been really impressed with Donnarumma. It also doesn't surprise me that he's so young. He's improved with ball distribution. I mean, he's by no means anywhere near remotely close to Alisson or anything like that, but he used to be a big liability there. He's improved in that aspect of his game. Pure shot stopper. He's definitely right there with the best in the league. His game overall has improved. His command of the defense has improved. So, yeah, I think you can make the best case for Donnarumma. I never gave up on him, so I'm glad this is one player that hasn't made me look bad.
All right, David, this is an interesting Twitter question. Do you think Milan should limit Çalhanoğlu's playing time to stop the bleeding with his transfer value?
It's an interesting question, but I have a couple of thoughts. I think ultimately the most important thing for Milan is making it to the Champions League spot. So it really comes down to, do you think Çalhanoğlu can help you or not, even if he's nowhere near as good as he was last year? And he was the player that improved the most under Gattuso. So I think you can't look at it so much transfer value. It's just you have to ask yourself, you know, what are my alternatives? Can someone step in and do better? The other thing of him not leaving in January is in the summer, it'll be a new fiscal year. His amortization will go down. You can sell him for cheaper than you would have sold them in January, and you still have a just as good, if not better, financial benefit. So I think you kind of have to look at it that way. He is probably the player on Milan that's taken the biggest dip recently. Suso hasn't been great either, but Suso, you know, is a pretty streaky player. I think he'll get going. So let's see what happens with Çalhanoğlu. I mean, it seems like Gattuso's been very loyal to him. So he just has to figure out what helps Milan on the pitch. The transfer value, I don't think they can think in those terms quite yet.
All right. I really enjoy this question, David. Who are the three most overrated players in Serie A?
So those that listen to the podcast know that I usually, for me, overrated players tend to fall in two categories. Either a young player where there's a very small sample size and we kind of, you know, it's a blank canvas. We project a lot onto them and we get them a little bit overrated. So maybe think someone like Locatelli, who I know has been a little bit better for Sassuolo recently, but really didn't start for long stretches of matches. I think his goal against Juve early in his career put him on a pedestal and all. So I'm going to put him in the mix too. Then it really comes down. Then I'm still going to say Rugani. I mean, he's been around for a long time. I just constantly see Juve fans making excuses for him. I think, you know, Benatia leaving, granted it wasn't that many matches. You know, we've had our friend Adam Digby on Monday. I really agree with his take. So I'm going to put him in the mix too. And then, you know, it's older players that are still big brand names and whose performance doesn't live up to it. Normally you would say Nainggolan falls in this, but he's taken such a dip this season that I'm not even sure we can say that applies to him anymore. I don't think he's overrated. I think now people really see that he's really more of a nuisance and a distraction than anything else. I would have thrown Hamsik in this as well. But now he left for China. I'm going to throw in a different name that doesn't completely fall in this category. And for me, this is Perin, the backup goalkeeper on Juve. I know he played for Padova. I tend to always give players from former Padova players a break. But I think he's really overrated. I think, you know, we were talking with Chloe Beresford, with Lafon, the goalkeeper on Fiorentina, is a great shot stopper, but there's more to the goalkeeper position. And I think Perin is like that, someone who very good shot stopper, not so much in other areas of the game. I think the fact that this season Allegri has benched him in a lot of matches where normally you would say it makes sense to play the backup really speaks volumes. So those are mine. At the end of the season, let's see if that list changes. So I'm going to go Locatelli, Rugani, Nainggolan, Hamsik, and Perin. You can pick three out of those five.
All right, well, a player that's certainly not overrated in my mind is in this next question. Actually, both players are not overrated in my mind. David, will Alexandro leave Juventus to gain funding for Ndombele?
Yeah, it's been a while since we had questions on Alexandro. So he signed an extension with Juve not that long ago, which doesn't necessarily mean that he won't leave. And, you know, Juve does have Spinazzola, who came back from an injury, a pretty promising player. But more importantly, they've been heavily linked to Marcelo, who doesn't seem to be, you know, position at Real Madrid doesn't seem as stable. We know how much Ronaldo loves Marcelo. We know Juve and Real Madrid have a great relationship. So if Marcelo comes, and maybe it'll be a cheaper deal because he is older, it would make sense maybe be Juve to cash in on Alexandro. And, you know, we were talking earlier, does Icardi make sense for Juve? Yeah, I mean, you could say that a lot of their strikers are older. But to me, they need to make a huge investment in the midfield. We'll get to Ramsey in a second and another potential name. But if selling Alexandro, and again, we know how scarce the left back position is on the market, they could still get a very good return on him. So I think that's something they should consider as much as I like Alexandro.
All right, next Twitter question is about everybody's favorite player right now. Does the fact that Zaniolo grew up as a Juventino make it more likely that he'll join Juve?
Great question. And I saw there's some people on Twitter that did a deep dives on old Zaniolo's social media when he was like a teenager. And he still is a teenager. He was like 14, 15. And it sounds like he's clearly a Juve fan. So, you know, this is pretty interesting because I think it cuts both ways, right? It really ultimately comes down to the player, how important this is to them. I mean, Pirlo grew up as a big Inter fan, and he played for Inter very briefly, and he couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. And then he went on to Milan and Juve. Then, you know, Chiellini grew up a big Milan fan, loved Maldini. He's a Juve captain now. Berardi, on the other hand, you know, big Interista. He was linked to Juve so many times that I'm not sure the reason he never ended up on Juve was really the Inter angle of things. I think it was more about his personality and whatnot. So I don't know. I think it depends on the player. But it's also interesting that, you know, Zaniolo had kind of a weird career in the youth systems, was on Fiorentina, wasn't considered good enough for their top team, then went to Virtus Entella in the second division. And then he signed with Inter to play for their Primavera. So, you know, if he's such a big Juve fan that he agreed to go to Inter, I mean, granted, he was smart to know. I mean, it was a transfer, so you got to wonder how much say he had into that. But I think he also knew how good Inter's youth system is. So it's interesting. I got to say, I never think this stuff matters that much. But maybe we live in a different age where the players have more say and whatnot. But I will say for Roma fans, just enjoy Zaniolo. I still think it makes no sense for anyone involved to sell Zaniolo next summer. But I can totally see why Juve fans could dream, because Zaniolo really is the real deal.
Yeah, I think the digging into players' childhoods really is at an all-time high. Almost every Chelsea rumor right now is like, oh, Jadon Sancho said he once was a Chelsea fan. Or, oh, Nicolas Pepe of Lille a few years back said he'd play for Chelsea. Or Leon Bailey was wearing a Chelsea hat years and years and years ago. Okay, okay, we get it. We get it. All right. There are also Red Sox players that were Yankees fans and vice versa. So let's move on. All right, David, what did you make of the reports Juventus will pay Aaron Ramsey $400,000 a week?
Look, you know, this is one thing that I learned from Di Marzio. You don't really talk about what other people report, say. You just worry about yourself and focus on that. And it's a very good lesson. And look, you know, this is opinion. Juve issued the statement. They made the Ramsey deal official. I have to say, one thing that was very interesting is the agent commission was much, much less than Emre Can. I think, if don't quote me, but I think it was just like $3.2 million. Pretty negligible overall. There was no mention, though, of the wages. But, you know, there's always confusion, because in the UK, wages are reported per week and before taxes, while in Italy, wages are reported on a yearly basis after taxes. So in England, and I saw the BBC, of all places, was running with this $400,000 a week. I was on TalkSport. They asked me about that. But this really doesn't make any sense to me. On the reports on Di Marzio's site, Gazzetta dello Sport, a lot of other places, the wage reported is 7 million euro net of taxes a season plus bonuses. That comes down to about 200,000 a week, so about half. That makes much more sense. And look, you know, the wages, if it's 7 million net, those are in line with what Pjanic and Dybala earn, so that makes much more sense than him earning double what they earn and half of Ronaldo. So to me, it doesn't make sense. The good news is we'll definitely get an answer on this, because it will be on Juve's next financial statement once Ramsey is on the balance sheet. Like, we'll see it there. So the answer would be there. But I would be absolutely shocked if it's 400,000 a week. I don't really worry about the reports of others, but once it's on the financial statement, it'd be nice if there'd be a retraction, because I know this gargantuan wage has really created a lot of buzz, but I hate to say it, I think it's wrong.
All right, talk about young prospects. Here we go. Can you predict the transfer costs for De Ligt, Zaniolo, and Tonali this coming summer?
Fascinating topic. So as I said before, I don't think Zaniolo will be sold this summer, because even more than these two other players, because De Ligt's been a starter for a while. Although, you know, a young center back like him, there's really been no equivalent. Someone that good, who's, I think he's 19, can be your top center back for like 12 years to come. That's almost unheard of. And he has Mino Raiola handling his transfer. If I had to guess for De Ligt, I would say 60 million, 50, 60 million sounds like the starting point, in my opinion, probably more. And then you think of all the clubs that are going to be interested in him There's reports Barcelona, Juve, Premier League clubs. I mean, he's a great player. Juve has the advantage of knowing Raiola really well. It is a big expense. Their defense is older. I don't believe in Rugani. So I'm going to say starting for De Ligt, 50, 60 million could go higher. Tonali, he's in Serie B at Brescia. I think 25, 30 million sounds about right to me. He's very young. A team can invest in him. Yeah, it's a big sum for a player of his age, but it can also something that you can have a lot of resale value. It's possible down the road, Tonali is a 60, 70 million euro player. So I'm going to guess that Zaniolo to me is really a mystery because he has such a small sample size and so brilliant. It's kind of hard to put a value on him. And he's been doing it in the Champions League now. My guess is, you know, he gets an extension at Roma. He's not definitely, but I think there's a strong chance he's on the team next year. And then we see what happens there.
All right, David, last Twitter question. Very interesting one. Can you rank the top leagues in Europe?
I could, but I refuse to because you guys know that how I feel about this, that there's nothing more petty, and I'm going to just put the word out there, childish, of getting into arguments on which league is better, especially when it's people that don't follow closely all the leagues. I don't feel like you have a good frame of reference. But to me, at the end of the day, you know, sports is entertainment and it's emotion and it's engagement that you have in the team. And I think both those things are incredibly subjective. So, you know, the reason that I follow Serie A, you know, I grew up in Italy, fell in love with the sport there. I feel a strong affinity towards the style of play in Serie A. I love the tactics of it. I love the drama that we have in Serie A. And, you know, I've been following the teams there my whole life. So I have an emotional and knowledge connection to it. So I think it really comes down to what you like best. And I think the childish arguments on which league is best, I got to say it, to me, show a lot of insecurity. So everyone enjoy what you like. There's definitely good reasons why every product the league can be really good. I mean, I think the Premier League, the presentation, there's drama at the top this season. Who will win the title, historic clubs, the coverage here in the U.S. is second to none. Definitely a lot of advantages to that. But again, I could see why someone would not be that interested in that and would be interested in other leagues. I think the Bundesliga has a lot to offer. La Liga, you know, those teams have done really well in the Champions League. Does that make them a better league? Maybe. But I'm not someone that's really thrilled with watching La Liga just because I don't have an emotional connection. So that's my thought on that. Just enjoy what you like and let others do that as well. So I want to thank our listeners for your questions. As always, you can send them in with the Calcioland hashtag. And I had someone saying that we never answer his questions. I do my best to go back to the tweets when we send out the tweets asking for questions. But please, if you use the hashtag, it's much easier for me to add it to the podcast. And also, I appreciate your support. We've had some great tweets from our listeners. This is a completely free podcast. Alex and I put a lot of effort in this. We've thrown in some considerable financial resources into the podcast. So please help us grow. You telling your Twitter followers or your friend about the podcast is a great way to do so. And also leaving us a review on iTunes goes a really long way. I'm going to challenge our listeners. My birthday is April 10th. Here in North America, we sit at 380 reviews, 5-star. I think out of those, 376 are 5-star reviews. I'm going to challenge you for my birthday. I'd really appreciate it if you get us to 400. We have about 6 weeks to make that happen. So thanks for your support. So we're going to close with our dear friend, Andrew Barker. This is a pretty long interview. We started with the drama on Icardi. The last question on Inter is I asked him, you know, if he thinks Icardi is going to be on the team beyond this season. Then after that, it's all about the Oscars and the movies. I think you'll really enjoy it. I've done a lot of these chats with Andrew. This was probably the one that came out the best. So if you are into the Academy Awards, I think you'll enjoy it. If you like movies, I think you'll enjoy it. If you're looking for things to watch on Netflix or on TV, I think there'll be some very interesting discussions there. So I want to thank Andrew for joining me and indulging me on movie talk. And we look forward to chatting with you guys next week where we'll do more interviews, talk about the Champions League, and wrap up what's happened in Serie A over the weekend. So thanks for listening. You guys know that anytime Andrew Barker comes on the podcast, I'm extra excited because we get to talk about Inter and also movies and sometimes music. So Andrew, as you guys by now know him, he's been on the podcast a bunch of times. He's a senior features writer at Variety, one of the best movie critics that I know, also a diehard Inter fan. So we have a lot of drama to talk about with the Oscars coming. But before we get to all that, I want to welcome you back, Andrew. Always a pleasure to have you on Couchland.
Always a pleasure to be here. Hello from cold, rainy, miserable Southern California. Hope it's better out in Boston.
Yeah, not too great over here. But let's start with Inter, because I have to say this is even more drama than any of the movies nominated in the Oscars, which we'll get to in the second part of the interview. So I have to say, I always tell people things change. The vibe on the team so fast that I never like to, you know, when people ask me stuff in February, what will happen in the summer, I always say, you know, it's just way too soon. So I have to say, yesterday I woke up and I saw Inter's cryptic tweet on Handanovic being the win. And that was later followed by the news that Icardi wasn't traveling with the team today. First, the reports were that he wasn't selected, and then it came out that he was selected, but he essentially refused it. So, Andrew, you've been following Inter for a long time. We've discussed Pazza Inter many times that you've been on. I have to ask you, what was your reaction to all this news yesterday?
Like you, I kind of saw that when I got up, and I was just like, what are people even talking about? And like, I just felt tired, man. I'm just tired, you know? as you mentioned, you know, the Pazza Inter thing, like, obviously I knew what I was getting into when I became an Inter fan, but the whole Pazza really stops being fun after a while, you know? I really don't expect all that much from Inter these days in terms of titles, but it would be nice to just have a season where Inter plays to the best of its abilities for a whole season and doesn't have any bonkers drama, you know? Like I can handle bad performances and defeats, but like, just give me one season where the team doesn't just collectively forget how to play football for several weeks at a time, and they don't have a whole telenovela season plot that plays out in the papers, and it'll be okay. And it's like, well, obviously that's not happening this season either. So yeah, it's kind of exhausting.
I hear that. So I want to ask you, you know, Icardi has been the captain for a while now, a young player. You know, you could see it. Maybe it was to elevate his profile, make it more enticing for him to stay. You know, we've seen some issues he's had with the Inter Ultras where he confronted them a while back. And based on what we've seen this year, maybe that's not so bad in hindsight. But I want to ask you, as far as the captain of the squad and the team, how do you kind of see him as a captain for this team? Do you think he should have been the captain in the first place?
You know, it's when you look at it in a vacuum, it was always an odd choice that they picked him, both, you know, for everything you mentioned. And there was, you know, his kind of tabloid notoriety and even just like his on the pitch personality. Like, there's really little in him that suggested he was like a leader of men. And like you kind of alluded to, I think it's very reasonable to suggest that his appointment had less to do with his actual suitability to the captaincy than it did with providing him something to tie him to the club. Because, you know, at the time he was named captain, Inter really didn't have much of a clear project to speak of. They didn't have much money. They weren't in Europe. And they desperately wanted to hang on to this burgeoning superstar who could have just walked out at any time. And so the captaincy was sort of like, okay, yeah, well, we'll make you an integral part of this club, will make you the face of this club. And so likewise, looking at it in a vacuum, now that Inter does have money and does have Europe, it's probably easier to take that away if he isn't living up to the role. Because, I mean, there's definitely a strong case you could probably make that he wasn't living up to the expectations of the armband, whether it's however he was behaving in the dressing room or more obviously his behavior around this contract negotiation. But that's in a vacuum. And so I think, you know, in the real world, it feels much more like a punitive measure that's intended to embarrass him and to chastise him than an actual correction, you know, for the fact that he wasn't quite living up to the armband.
Yeah, he strikes me maybe as someone as more of a follower than really a leader. And I think, you know, Wanda, you know, I don't think compared to some agents that act very similar to her, but he seems extremely passive with letting her handle that. So I want to ask you, with Inter, you know, with Marotta coming towards the beginning of the season, we saw, you know, maybe Inter trying to change a little bit their MO. And at Juve, even well before Marotta, there was nobody bigger than the club. I think the fact that even when Ronaldo arrived at the team, they didn't, you know, do a stadium presentation with all the fans. They did a very standard presentation. Juve's been all about that. And it seems like Marotta has really tried to bring this and more discipline. So I wanted to get your take on this potential change, because at Inter, those that, and you followed them when Moratti was around, the president before Sunin, they really coddled the players. The players were never afraid to go behind the coach's back if they weren't happy with what they were told. And, you know, and the president would usually appease them. So tell me a little bit, how do you feel about this MO change? And do you feel even like potentially sacrificing Icardi to really drive home this point, would that be worth it in your opinion?
You know, I mean, I think you diagnose the transition that's happening, as far as I can tell, pretty accurately there. And I'm honestly conflicted about it. Like, I know I've seen the reaction from a lot of Inter fans are they're really singing Marotta's praises here. Like, you know, whether it's kind of him sort of giving Raja Nainggolan a slap upside the head or bringing the hammer down on Icardi this time, that's like, okay, finally someone's taking control of the club. And I definitely understand that sentiment. But I don't know, maybe it's that I'm always been kind of a sentimentalist, I guess. And as much as it sometimes was detrimental to the team, I always admired Massimo Moratti's just genuine affection and generosity toward his players. I mean, the flip side of that was that he was absolutely ruthless on the coaches, but just had these, I mean, just real humanity toward players, you know? I mean, like, you hear from, like, Nicolas Paradiso, and he still talks about the way he was treated at the club when his child got seriously ill. And Kanu was kept on the team while he struggled with this heart condition, and, you know, he still thanks Moratti for the way he treated him. Or you look at the way Moratti, like, really went out of his way to help Adriano when he really started to fall apart psychologically. Like, I actually respect those things on a human level, and it's one of the things that really did help me develop a relationship with this club. You know, because these people are all obviously multi-million dollar earning, you know, commodities, but they're also human beings. And so, I mean, like, and on the other side, like even myself as someone who hates everything associated with Juve, like I was honestly taken aback a little by the unceremonious way that like Del Piero was kind of pushed out and then Marchisio to a lesser extent. But, you know, of course, being the Moratti type leaves you prone to being taken advantage of. And Moratta clearly isn't that kind of guy to be taken advantage of. And, you know, in this case, something like clearly had to give at some point. I mean, it's pretty insane when you look at the basic terms of negotiation that Icardi has not yet gotten his contract extension. Like it seems like it's in everyone's interest to do so. You know, he's making, you know, in his defense, he's making, I think, well below the market rate for a player of his abilities. Yep. So he's totally right to demand a raise, and Inter needs to get rid of or raise his buyout clause. So something's clearly gone really pear-shaped when you're in a negotiation where both sides have reasonable demands that everyone can live with, and yet it goes nowhere. And so, you know, like you mentioned Wanda, and, you know, I'm always like tempted to try to seek out some secret genius of her whole non-traditional Instagram-based negotiation tactics, but it definitely feels like she overplayed her hand here and has done real damage to both parties involved. But as for Marotta in general, I mean, I obviously he knows, you know, he knows 1,000 times more than I'll ever know, but I wonder about just the differences in culture that you mentioned at Inter compared to Juve. You know, like I always think back to Antonio Cassano talking about why he would never go to Juve because they expect everyone to behave like little soldiers, you know, and I think that's probably right. And then Inter is always kind of like this weird artist's colony / halfway house / island for misfit toys, you know, so there's much more of a possibility that that kind of tough love can backfire here. So I'm curious to see how it plays out, but I think you diagnose the situation pretty spot on.
Yeah, but you know, I appreciate your perspective, because this is really the difference between Inter and Juve, and it makes the rivalry more interesting. And you know, right. The Wanda point, her negotiation tactics, like it felt like Inter, because there's a lot of reports that Icardi and her found out about the captaincy thing via Twitter. They weren't told ahead of time, so it's like they paid them back in the same fashion. So
exactly.
Before we transition,
they kind of deserve
that. Yeah, you know. Before we transition to movies, I want to ask you, simply put, because you made it's an excellent point, you know, he's not in the top 10 highest paid player in Serie A, and he definitely deserves to be. There is this buyout clause, and, you know, it's very hard to find goal scorers like him. So do you think everyone's going to, you know, reach their senses and figure they need each other? Or if you think at the end of the season, in the summer, Icardi will be gone?
I think probably the latter. I mean, obviously anything can happen and probably will. But if I had to like put money on one or the other, I'd say Icardi is in Madrid or England next September. And, you know, it is what it is. You know, I think on one hand that'll present interesting opportunities and pitfalls for Inter if they are in a position where they have all this money and need to replace him. Because I honestly don't think that there exists right now a like-for-like replacement out there who can equal Icardi's conversion rate and his just goal scoring ability. Like, I mean, not that that player doesn't exist, but I don't see us attracting the Sergio Aguero or the Mbappe type of player to this club, you know. And once you start looking at the level below that, it gets kind of thin. So in the absence of that, it does give the team an opportunity to think about how the team can play differently. Because Icardi is a world-class goal scorer, but he's also, as we see right now, he's a very difficult person, and he's someone with a limited skill set, right? No matter how high level those skills are, they're limited. And so the fact that he can single-handedly win matches where the team isn't creating anything and isn't really playing well, it papers over a lot of deeper structural issues. Like, I remember in the Ibrahimovic years, like, Inter's attacking tactics were basically give it to Ibra and he'll do something. And it's kind of similar to our tactics now, which is basically like keep throwing the ball into the box and eventually Icardi will find it. And so when Ibra left, there was no way to replace that kind of one-man wrecking crew forward line where he's one guy who creates the chances, who converts the chances. So instead, we picked up two strikers and a trequartista to kind of share that burden, and the benefits of doing that were obvious. And so right now, an Interless Icardi is kind of faced with the same situation. And especially, you know, we have obviously a very promising yet not fully there young striker in Lautaro Martinez. And the whole deal is doesn't seem to be capable of playing with Icardi. So the question to ask is, who can he play with? You know, if we're not going to replace Icardi directly, and Lautaro is nowhere near the time when he'd be able to pick up the slack, maybe like a reset on our whole attacking structure would be a good idea. But aside from that, one thing that does make me a little depressed about kind of pondering the inevitability of Icardi leaving is that, you know, Mauro Icardi is the ninth highest scorer in Inter history. And he managed to do that before turning 26. I mean, that's pretty incredible. And
it is.
The player he passed on that list is Bobo Vieri. And there's just something really unfortunate about the idea that, like, the only two players on Inter's all-time scoring list that I've actually seen play both lift the club in, like, these bitter, acrimonious circumstances. You know, it's a bummer to have that be, like, the capper on a career that he's had at the club.
Yeah, and, you know, not only before 26, but also on some particularly not good Inters. And this goes back to what you were saying at the top, you know, he did tough it out during the bad year. So it's unfortunate. And again, you know, so much can change, but for some reason, I have a feeling it's going to kind of work out. But let's see if this is being overly optimistic. So let's switch over to movies. You know, I love having you on to talk about movies. I want to talk to you a little bit about the Oscars. We've had you on about a few months ago. We talked about Bohemian Rhapsody and some of those. We won't touch on those. So I have to ask you, Get Out, I know, has been one of your favorite movies from recent years. I think, you know, when I look back to last year, that's the movie that I'm definitely going to remember the most. Every time it's on TV, I always end up watching it. Out of the movies that are nominated for the Oscars right now, which one do you think is the closest to being the movie we're going to remember from this year?
You know, the funny thing about that is, like for me, working at a trade paper at Life Variety, we do so much coverage on every minute aspect of the Oscar race and the movies involved in it, like starting with the festivals, starting in late summer, all through like all of these hundreds of smaller awards and nominations and scandals and thousands of interviews and photo shoots and et cetera, et cetera. So that when the Oscars are finally over, I always get this feeling like thank God, now I don't have to ever think about any of these movies again, you know? But that's obviously like a special case. And so I think
that sounds like me after a transfer window. I love
exactly,
it.
You understand. Yeah. It's like, I don't care if these players just disappear into the ether. I'm done with them. I'm done. But if I were a normal person who just watched movies like a normal person, I think of three that I think will kind of linger in the memory. Most obviously Black Panther, you know, which is, you know, the most successful movie of the last year financially. It was a cultural event, you know, it meant a lot beyond just the Marvel universe. And it introduced all these characters who we're going to keep seeing again and again and again, you know, in Black Panther 2 and like, you know, Avengers Part 7, Chinese Democracy or whatever they're going to call it. And like, so I think that clearly is one that sticks. And on the kind of opposite end of the spectrum, I think it was a much smaller movie, but I think, did you see Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, perchance?
I have, but I've heard really great things about it. So it's on my list. It's not really my genre, but I've heard amazing things about it.
It's not really my genre either, but I think that's going to have a legacy to it. Because, I mean, for me going into it, it's like, this is a movie about the absolute last character I wanted to see another movie about. I mean, Spider-Man, like it just, you know, why would I care? And yet this movie managed to take actual chances and do something kind of radical with it. So just looking at it, like, I feel like if we're going to have a near future where like 90% of what's in theaters is either a Marvel movie or a Star Wars movie or whatever, like this is actually a model of how you can go into a property like that and color outside the lines, you know, like I can't remember the last time I saw a mainstream superhero movie and thought, I've actually never seen a movie like that before. And so that's encouraging. And I think even more so than its popularity, which is, you know, nowhere near that of Black Panther, I think people were kind of inspired by this movie and kind of what it suggests. And a third one, on a totally different note, like, I don't think it's going to win any of the big Oscars, but I think we'll be surprised by how well A Star Is Born will kind of stick around in the cultural conversation. Because I think the depth of affection that people have for that movie is kind of continually surprising for me. It has, you know, this hugely successful music associated with it, and people tend to hold on to music more closely than they do films, which gives it longevity. You know, like you look at how well Frozen has stuck around, despite not being a particularly great movie. It has a song in it that every single little girl in America knows by heart. So that movie is never going away. So I think that helps. And A Star Is Born also, I think it's really caught on. Not that I'm part of this community, but it seems like it's really caught on in the gay community. And if you know anything about pop culture history, when the gay community gets behind a movie, like it stays around forever, you know, like, like there's a reason people still watch like Mommy Dearest and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, you know, it's not because they're good movies. It's because they've kind of entered the culture through that kind of route. So I think that one is, you know, even though it's the fourth Star Is Born ever like in a series, I think that's going to have a surprising longevity.
I completely agree that if I had to pick one, it would be that with Black Panther right behind it. So let's stay on A Star Is Born. I think it had a lot of momentum when it came out for the Oscars. It sounds like a lot of that momentum has stalled in the nominations when they came out. So I have to ask you, and this is kind of half, not really, what do you think was a bigger snub? The fact that Bradley Cooper wasn't nominated for Best Director? That Andrew Dice Clay, who played Lady Gaga's dad, wasn't nominated for Best Supporting Actor?
You know, I mean, props to Andrew Dice Clay, because I always like to see anyone have an actual second act. You know what I mean? Like, I would never have thought, you know, the Dice Man or whatever would you know, get to be in movies like this, or Woody Allen movies or whatever they are. I mean, I thought he was fine. I don't think there was any – I don't think he's sweating it. And with the Bradley Cooper thing, that's another funny one to me. Cause I feel like the reaction to Bradley Cooper not getting a best director nomination for the Oscars, he did get a best actor nomination. I feel like that there's been like two predominant reactions to it, which are both kind of inexplicable to me. The first being that Bradley Cooper, who's this, you know, impossibly handsome, well-respected, super wealthy movie star whose first film as a director made $200 million, is someone I should somehow feel bad about because he only got one Oscar nomination, you know, which is like, no. And then the other is there's also this weird through line with among film Twitter and people like that it's somehow like his fault for not campaigning enough, or that he seemed pretentious in interviews, or like, I don't even know. So like my response to both of those, but the Cooper one in particular, is that I kind of feel nothing, you know, like the man literally just won a Grammy last weekend for this movie. And he's going to continue being handsome and successful, and a studio is going to write him a giant check for whatever movie he wants to make next. You know, like he basically won the lottery, but he got a carrot cake instead of a chocolate cake for his birthday. Like, you know, he'll live. That's my take on that.
Yeah. So now I was going to ask you, you know, if it's true that he's not particularly a community, but I think you already answered that. So let me ask you, the last time you were on, you told me that Roma is your favorite movie in the past few years. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but if I remember correctly, you said that. And I hadn't seen it at the time and asked you if I should go see it in the theater. And you told me, definitely do that. So I went to the theater and then I watched it on Netflix a few times, some scenes. Just incredibly powerful movie. I was surprised by how much I enjoyed rewatching it on Netflix. And to me, there were really some images that really will stay with me for a very long time. So I have to ask you, you know, what scenes or what images like really stood out to you the most?
I think, and I'm glad you liked it too. I think there's a lot. I think the two of the most obvious ones are, there's the big New Year's Eve party scene, which is just like, you know, it's that big surrealist, bizarre, you know, enveloping kind of image of it with the guy singing the song and the fire.
Yeah.
And at the end, where Yalitza goes into the waves, like I legitimately think I held my breath for that entire scene the first time I saw it. So those are obviously incredible. But I think like one of the ones I was most impressed with is the scene toward the very beginning where we see Yalitza in like this super wide angle going to each room in the house and saying goodnight to everyone. And
yeah.
It's a like low key scene in a way, but, you know, Alfonso Cuarón is such a master of like the big flashy technique. You know, he's almost like this kind of prog rock filmmaker. He's like a Pink Floyd big technical achievement kind of guy. You know, and so you look at like, you know, when he does like that one take war scene in Children of Men, or a lot of the stuff he does in Gravity, you know, just like mind boggling technique. And so I was impressed to see him do like a similarly technically demanding, difficult scene in such an unflashy way that really like orientates you to the rest of the film, you know, because you just have like this one wide angle and nothing particularly noteworthy is happening, but you see laid out just on a giant canvas who this family is and how they relate to each other and just the exact layout of this house where you're going to spend most of the film. And it's all just sort of right in front of you like this big organ, and you understand who these people are without them having to explain it in dialogue, you know, and to get into the details.
Yeah.
So I thought that was such a, you know, it's easy to kind of overlook, but it's such a mature use of what can normally be like a really flashy kind of technique. What about you?
Yeah, I have to say, obviously the New Year's Eve and the fire was great. I really enjoyed when the father shows up in the car, cars to get into the driveway, and all the suspense of that one was great. And I thought the martial arts scene out in the desert is another one that really stands out. Like, I have to ask you, if this wasn't in black and white, do you feel like some of these scenes would resonate as much? Do you think that gave it an extra boost or not really?
Definitely. I think definitely so. I mean, both, partially just because, obviously Roma's the neighborhood of Mexico City, but you know, you think of like Roma Città Aperta or something like that. Like it's calling you back to that whole Italian neorealist style of filmmaking, even though it's set in the 70s and with an entirely different kind of style of storytelling. But also just, yeah, I mean, there's a, like that, you talk about that martial arts scene, and if that was in color, I think you'd be, because it takes part in the place in this really kind of poor area of town, right, as I believe. And so somehow having it in the black and white, you're taken away from kind of the more kind of colorful details of, you know, and the kind of mess and tumult of what would be around, and you're just focused on this kind of spectacle. You know what I mean? Like it would kind of lean more into the nostalgic cheesiness of it, but with it in black and white, yeah. Just you're impressed with who are these people? Why are they being trained? You know, and just, yeah, the how striking an image that is. So yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So Cuarón, of course, did the cinematography. So I have to ask you, he's nominated for Best Director. It sounds he's the clear favorite. You think, you know, because the cinematography is so incredible, it almost gives him an unfair advantage with the director, or can you really separate the two?
I mean, maybe, you know, maybe a little bit. I think, you know, I've seen people suggest that cinematographers are almost a little bit touchy about like directors stealing their job from them, you know? I mean, you know, and to be fair, he only shot the movie himself because Emmanuel Chivo Lubezki, who usually shoots for both him and Iñárritu, just couldn't do it. So he did it himself. So, I mean, it might give him an advantage in the directors, but I think cinematographers kind of are a little more protective of their space, you know?
Okay, so let's talk about a movie that is completely different than Roma, as this is Green Book. I hadn't seen it when you came on. So here's kind of my take on that movie. I was like, if you just watch it as a buddy movie, as like a comedy, as, you know, great performances, like I think it's a really fun time at the movies. I think if you try to look at it on a deeper level, it's like, okay, this is the director of Something About Mary trying to teach me about racism. So I put this take out on Twitter, and it was interesting. Some people came back to me. I'm not in movie Twitter like you, and we're like, you know, this is kind of a snobbish take. Can't you just enjoy a movie? Like, I went with my wife. She absolutely loved it. I mean, I enjoyed it. I had a great time, but, you know, I could pick it apart in a lot of ways. So I have to ask you, you know, do you think it's a little bit snobbish to try to expect it to be this story on an important issue, or do you think people should just enjoy it? How do you feel about that?
I think it's interesting you talk about like talking about it on Twitter, because I think this is probably the most controversial movie in the Oscar season this year, and I think there's as you know, anyone can observe with a variety of topics, there's a thing that happens on social media sometimes where it feels like there's only one acceptable take to have, you know, and that is definitely something that happened with this movie, and that rarely honors the multiplicity of sort of takes someone can have, you know. Like, I think this is a movie that was made with very good intentions, and if someone tells me that they just enjoyed it, or if they tell me that they got a lot out of it and it touched them and it made them think about things differently, like, I would never in a million years tell them that's wrong, because that's not wrong. You know, it is an entertaining buddy movie, and, you know, and you can also, there's people like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and John Singleton and Harry Belafonte have all defended this movie in some way. And I would never tell those guys that they're wrong about race in America, you know? But I do think it is important to talk about the politics of this movie, whether one enjoyed it or not, you know, because like the issues with this movie like exist far beyond this film, you know. I mean, for example, it was, I think maybe exactly like 30 years ago that Driving Miss Daisy and Do the Right Thing both came out in the same year. And of course, Driving Miss Daisy won Best Picture and Do the Right Thing wasn't even nominated. And ever since then, we've always been talking about Hollywood's tendency to make and to award movies about race that sometimes strive to be crowd pleasing, that kind of look for happy endings instead of more complicated endings, and sometimes that privilege the white person's journey through racism. And that's an open conversation, I think. You know, we've talked about that when The Help came out and when Crash came out. And I think it's relevant to this movie. So it doesn't, the existence of that conversation shouldn't complicate someone's positive experience of that movie. You know what I mean? And I feel like the conversation that gets lost and it just kind of becomes a right and wrong thing, and that it's wrong to just enjoy it as a movie. But I think you can't help but bring those issues up when this movie does fit into that tradition and to that really longstanding debate. I'm not sure where I went with that answer, but I don't know.
No, it makes sense to me. So I'm going to piggyback on this. This is a perfect transition. You mentioned Do the Right Thing. So Spike Lee got his first nomination for Black Klansman. So let me ask you, is this more, I don't know, I know I'm exaggerating this. This is the first time he's nominated for this movie, which, you know, probably I would imagine you don't rank it as one of his best. Or when Scorsese finally won for The Departed, which for me, when I think of Scorsese, it's not even in the top 10 of his career. So tell me a little bit, do you think one's a bigger travesty than the other? Or are you just glad he's finally getting nominated?
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, I think it would be pretty much exactly the same deal as Scorsese. And, you know, the two of them are buddies. So, you know, they both have that NYU connection, Spike Lee and Scorsese. But yeah, you know, the Oscars are always kind of giving out these make good awards for people they screwed up with the first time. You know, that's what happened with Scorsese, with The Departed. That's what happened when Pacino won for Sinful Woman and Denzel Washington won for Training Day. So I really hope he wins. This is probably the category I care the most about. And it's not because I love Black Klansman. I think it's a good quality Spike Lee film. But I think, you know, whatever you think about Spike Lee, he's controversial. He can be hit and miss, but he's an absolutely major voice of the last four decades of film. So yeah, for this to be his first nomination for director is pretty embarrassing for the Oscars. And I think it would be a good career recognition if he were to get it here.
Okay. So let me ask, really enjoyed it. And I found it so original that I really don't have a good question to ask you. This is the favorite. And I want to ask you simply, were you surprised such a non-conventional movie got nominated so much, got so many nominations? And what was your take on the film overall?
Yeah, I was surprised. And as for the film, did you ever see Dogtooth?
I'm sorry, which one was that?
Dogtooth.
Ever see that? No, movie? I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. So Dogtooth is the first movie that Yorgos... No, it wasn't. So Yorgos Lanthimos, who directed The Favourite, that was sort of his breakthrough movie in Greek from a couple years ago. And it's not a movie that I know if I could just recommend outright, because it's not like particularly violent or anything, but it's like mind-bogglingly uncomfortable and just perverse. Like, it's one of those, like, what the hell am I watching kinds of movies. I know this woman who's like a hardcore horror fan, you know, like the kind of person who can just, like, you know, watch Cannibal Holocaust over breakfast. And she had to turn it off because it was just messing with her head in a way that she didn't like. So I don't know. I think of, you know, 8 or 9 years ago watching that movie and going, what is going on? And the idea that the director of that movie would be making these multiple Oscar nominated films in English with Emma Stone in them a couple years later is staggering, you know? And I would not have believed that at the time at all. So honestly, The Favorite is not one of my favorites of his. Honestly, I feel like Lanthimos as a director, he has like really just one tone and one mode, that kind of like really bleakly absurdist, super dry, dark sense of humor. And I feel like he kind of keeps refining it and cleaning it up every film, but I don't feel like he ever does anything different. Like, I just kind of feel like I'm watching a new version of the same sort of strange, freaky, you know, model that was at its freakiest the first time I saw it, you know, because like Dogtooth to this is, you know, The Favorite is basically a Marvel movie comparison. But I wasn't blown away by this movie, but I think it is fantastic that he's there with a Best Director nomination, you know, at the damn Oscars. Like, and that's kind of why I don't care that, you know, Bradley Cooper, whoever, didn't get nominated, you know, because he can, that man can do whatever he wants. But like Yorgos Lanthimos and Pavel Pavlikovsky, you know, who's also kind of a surprise nomination, they're going to take this attention and do something with it on a level that might not have ever been available to them otherwise. So I'm very happy to see him there.
Yeah, that of his movies, I only saw The Lobster before, and that one I really enjoyed. I want to close on this. I want to surprise you. I want to simply ask you, we talked a lot about Bohemian Rhapsody, the flaws, the good, the bad last time. I want to ask you, we're coming up to the Oscars. I think right now Rami Malek is the favorite to win Best Actor. Do you think he ultimately gets the statue for it?
Yes, definitely. Definitely the favorite.
And do you think, are you kind of okay with this, or would he be your pick? Because, I mean, we know how you feel about the movie. I mean, I think maybe degree of difficulty, that was one of the hardest roles. Do you think he would win there? I know Christian Bale for Dick Cheney's are there. Do you think, though, in a lot of ways, although the movie's flawed, he would deserve it?
Yeah, he's going to win, like, most likely. I mean, that's one of the safest bets, I think, of the Oscars. But no, I'm not okay with it, actually. I mean, I think he's one of the best things about that movie. But it's just, I don't know, man. Yeah, you know what? Actually, what's a bummer about the Best Actor this year is, I mean, actually, check me on this. I think Bradley Cooper is the only person nominated who's not playing a real person. I think that's true. Which is just like, so, okay, are we just... Is that what acting is now? Is just, you know, mimicry? So if it is, then I think, you know, Christian Bale had a much higher degree of difficulty than Freddie Mercury was. I mean, I'm not mad about it, but no, I'm not okay with it. How's that?
Yeah, so I'm double-checking now. Did William Dafoe play a real person? Obviously, Viggo Mortensen. I mean, I don't know about Dafoe. If he played a real person, you're completely
Yeah,
right.
he was Vincent Van Gogh, yeah. So yeah. And then,
oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. He always seems to be nominated for really obscure movies. I haven't seen that one. So listen, Andrew, I can't thank you enough to talk to you about movies. And obviously, your takes on Inter fantastic too. So thank you so much for joining me once again on Cultureland. I look forward to doing this again very soon.
Absolutely. Anytime, David.